Okay, we're back on tape. I think we've finished collaboration.
Yeah, just
here.
To continue the collaboration thing, because I mentioned not just doing what the chairman asks you.
Well,
I also do collaborate with my chairman, by the way, but it's in a topic that I have a lot of interest on. That's ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And he, of course, he pushes for me to do more work on that. And, you know, I like the topic, and I am funded to do so, so I'm glad to do that. Sometimes we also have other collaborations that, you know, I might have less of an interest or less time to do it. But I can be honest with him and say that, you know, that's maybe going a little bit too far. But that's one thing that I'm sure lots of young researchers have to deal with. Also, people that, you know, have some influence in their lives, asking them to do something, and what to do then.
Okay. Well, it sounds like, though, if you can say no, that's a good relationship.
Yeah, we have a good relationship.
Okay. Well, I want to go back. We got a little bit sidetracked, although they were two topics I wanted to talk about. But I do want to go back a little bit and talk about the significance that this work that you're doing will have in terms of our understanding of the sort of the basic processes that go on.
Well, tremendous significance.
Of course.
Well, yeah, of course I would like it to be very significant, and that's what I'm always trying to do. The part related to mutations found in patients, I guess the best payoff would be in patient diagnostics, treatments, and counseling in the short term. Of course, these mutations also help us understand how different genes work, because, you know, they're natural mutants. So that's building up on the knowledge of mitochondrial genetics and mitochondrial biology in general. Mitochondria was usually seen as, you know, an energy factory in the cell, but more recently it's becoming more and more important for different processes like cell death, for example. And it might mediate a number of signals inside the cell. So it's like any basic research, I think it's hard to predict what kind of impact it ultimately will have. But yeah, the way it's working right now, I think it's just another building block on our knowledge on those processes. And that's how most of science advances, I think, with those little pieces. Now, if you're asking me if any particular result I found or I had, you know, had was a major breakthrough that would take the field to a different level, I don't think I have contributed at this level, even though some people might say I had, particularly at the clinical level, you know, describing how certain mutation would correlate with a certain clinical phenotype. You know, we published some relatively important papers on this field. But that was coming, would be coming from a different lab, I think, if we hadn't published within the year or 2 years. So in terms of you know, something that really was a major leap, I'm still waiting to give that kind of contribution. And that's my view. Julia would say that I'm always like that. That's my wife. That you know, I'm never happy with the work. I even though I said that I enjoy the lows and ups, she says that I get stuck into the lows and I forget that, you know, that's how it goes. But yeah, I'm always, you know, trying to get something better than what I had before.
That's a trait of scientists, I think, isn't it?
I guess, yeah.
Although some people believe, and it sounds like, you know, you just said that somebody else would have published it if you hadn't. Some people feel there's an inevitability to all of this, that it really doesn't matter if you do it, somebody will do it. Do you think that's true?
But someone I didn't. No, yeah, that's how I see it. Mm-hmm. Again, that's how I see the science evolving, you know, mm-hmm. those little building blocks that mm-hmm. lead to something. Mm-hmm. And then the questions, usually, I wouldn't say that they're obvious, but they're a consequence of that building up. Mm-hmm. And if you, you know, it's very common to see 3 or 4 papers published on the same topic at the same time, mm-hmm. because that's how the field is developing. Mm-hmm. And all these 4 papers might be breakthroughs. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, like maybe last year or 2 years ago, we published a paper where we put the rat mitochondrial DNA into a mouse cell. Why is that relevant? Because, you know, these cells were defective, and there would be the basis for it to produce a mouse that has a mitochondrial disease. That would be a neat model of mitochondrial mm-hmm. disease. So, the same year, there was a group in Japan that published the same thing and a group in Australia that published the same thing. Uh-huh. Exactly the same thing. So 3 papers coming up together because that's how the field was developing mm-hmm. with this. Mm-hmm. No. So, yeah, there is an inevitability mm-hmm. in these results, I think.
I suppose some people would say there's a synergy, you know, of yeah. energy.
But, you can call it that.
Yeah. Okay.
And I try also, when I know that someone is doing the same thing I'm doing, mm-hmm. and this happened twice in my career, and I was very pleased in both times, I try to contact the person and try to publish together, mm-hmm. same journal, the same time, submitting together. Because mm-hmm. I think that increases the impact of both papers.
And it avoids getting scooped.
Also. And, you know, it's usually a friend, so then mm-hmm. there are no hard feelings mm-hmm. also. Mm-hmm. So twice we did that, and twice mm-hmm. they were accepted back to back, and I was very pleased.
That's great. Yeah. Okay. Well, one of the questions that I find interesting is, where do the ideas that you have come from, besides the shower?
Well, besides the shower, I really don't know. It's amazing that, you know, yeah. You see how is my day to day, how I'm yeah. running from one side uh-huh. to another. It's really hard to have good ideas when you are in this space.
Yeah.
You know, the shower is it's a joke, but it's really serious. The only yeah. time that I can actually think mm-hmm. And stop and relax. Of course, I can also do that. Some other times when I'm relaxing. But besides that, I'll say during meetings, talking to people, and you know, of course, every time you review a grant or review a paper, that you get some information that might help you, you know, have some new ideas. Mm-hmm. But I have to say that my best ideas I have when I'm relaxed and I have time to think. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, it's time that's at premium now. I don't mm-hmm. have much. Mm-hmm. Between family and work, mm-hmm. and running up and down, and yeah, a few minutes every day.
Yeah.
And it's a real problem because, you know, as we discussed, I have many projects going on. And I feel that some are neglected, at least at the point of view of my intellectual input, because I quickly review data with someone in the lab, and just, you know, the obvious thing comes to mind, let's do this, but I'm not putting enough thought into this project, mm-hmm. and the person that's leading the project might not be experienced mm-hmm. or might not have the same knowledge I have, and I have a problem with that, mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. That's why the administrative burden bothers me so much, mm-hmm. because it's giving me less and less time of thinking about the project mm-hmm. and directing people mm-hmm. better.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll come back to that again, I think, before we finish today. But one of the things that or one of the ways that scientific advancement, I don't know if it's frequent, but sometimes comes along, is by serendipity. And first of all, how important is serendipity in science in general, and then in your work?
Yeah, I think it's very important. Chance is a major player in this field, I think. And that's why I think it's important to do experiments, sometimes even if they're a little bit of oddball experiments, because sometimes you get unexpected results, and that can lead to something interesting. Might not lead to anything, but once in a while. So I think it's very important. And I would say that frequently major breakthroughs will come like that. I agree with that. Has it happened to me? Yes, it has, I think, once. Well, I don't know if I'll call that serendipity, but we were analyzing DNA from a patient that had a mitochondrial disease. And we, you know, we had a problem with this, what we call southern blots, when we run the DNA on a gel and then use a specific radioactive probe to detect, in my case, the mitochondrial DNA. Mm-hmm. But we could not see the DNA there. And the usual explanation for that is that the DNA is not good, it's degraded. And I repeated a couple of times, and, you know, I was very junior in the lab, that was in New York. And more senior people would say, well, I don't know, there's something wrong with this. But, I don't know, maybe in the shower or somewhere, or walking to work, I just thought, you know, maybe that's the problem with this patient. Maybe the levels of mitochondrial DNA are really low, and we cannot even see. Mm-hmm. Ended up to be true. And, you know, we defined a whole new group of patients that have this quantitative defect, mm-hmm. mitochondrial DNA, that were confirmed all over the world. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting. It was not chance, but it's an example of how, you know, unexpected results are dismissed somehow.
Right.
And they can be very relevant. And they're just in front of you, and for some reason you don't see it because you're so focused in one expectation. And I guess that's an important lesson. Yeah. You know, just keep an open mind and try to see the possibilities.
I often wonder what serendipity is anyway, or synchronicity, or, you know, well, what.
Some people say that, how do they say that, luck comes to the prepared mind. So, yeah, what is it anyways? I guess it's the ability to see an unexpected result, mm-hmm. and to identify something novel in that. Mm-hmm. Because probably, you know, those strange results will happen all the time. You know, you're not always ready to interpret them, mm-hmm. and see if they have any meaning.
Right. Okay. Well, we just touched very briefly on, you know, what might come out of your work, but are there any potential applications that you can think of that yeah. might actually happen?
Well, treatment for mitochondrial disease. Mm-hmm. That's the most direct one. You know, lots of the projects we have are directed towards improving the defect caused by mutations in the mitochondrial DNA. Those diseases have no treatment whatsoever these days.
This would be, for example, what the names of some.
Well, they have usually strange names like Kearns-Sayre syndrome, because Dr. Kearns and Dr. Sayre describe it. They're called MRF, that stands for myoclonus epilepsy with ragged red fibers. That's a muscle abnormality. Or MELAS, that's mitochondrial encephalopathy with lactic acidosis and stroke-like episodes. So they have really strange names.
Yeah. So not real common.
They're not common. They're rare diseases. But, yeah, they occur. Mm-hmm. And treatment would be welcome. Mm-hmm. Not to mention that the potential involvement of mitochondrial defects in neurodegenerative disorders is becoming more and more involved. Mm-hmm. Things like Parkinson's disease or ALS or Alzheimer's mm-hmm. disease. might benefit from, you know, our better understanding of how mitochondrial dysfunction mm-hmm. affects the cell. So I guess those would be the most direct beneficial outcomes of my research.
Those sound like prime candidates for gene therapy of some sort.
In a way, the only problem is that we cannot do gene therapy with mitochondrial genes.
Oh.
But
because you can't get them into the mitochondria.
Right. But we still could, you know, have genes that will have a beneficial effect, even if we have to put them in the nucleus.
Mm-hmm. Well, it, you know, applications brings up then the issue of patents. Do you have any patents?
No, and that's really something that I'm not crazy about. Of course, if I discover something that's profitable, I'd love to have it patented. But I think people are overdoing the patenting thing. And, you know, any variation of a result from anything. By the way, this is Helene Coffee, not me. So don't transcribe that.
Let me pause for a second. Okay, we're back on tape.
Right. So, you know, I've seen people patenting completely ridiculous things. And that takes a lot of time and energy, not only from the investigator, but from the university also. Mm-hmm. And also it becomes harder for scientists to exchange material. And I have a problem with that. So, no, I do not have any patents. I would patent only something that I only if I had something that I truly see the potential as something that has a commercial use. But it's something that it's going to be used mainly in academic labs and things like that.
Like a gene sequence or something.
Right. Unless something exceptional. But even a technique or a device that, you know, it's just going to be used in labs. I wouldn't even try to patent.
Well, I want to move on and talk a little bit about some ethical considerations. We're going to wax a little philosophical now, because there are many in science. And I've thought of three areas that I want to talk about, but if you can think of any others, you're welcome to add to the list. The first has to do with, let's say, the way scientists behave. And you hear stories about people who, you know, will give somebody a low score on their grant because they're in direct competition, or a reviewer who doesn't like a paper because he's going to publish the same thing. Or that's kind of one end of the spectrum. Well, I don't know if it's one end, but that's one set of things. The other thing is just downright falsification of data. Have you, in your career, run into any of these kinds of things?
I think researchers behave very well, usually.
Well, that's good to hear.
You know, my experience, going to the first topic first, that is, you know, how if a reviewer will give a low score to a competitor or something like that. With my experience in study sections and review groups, I see that people really try very hard to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
And I try very hard to be fair. And I also, you know, if it's something in direct competition, and I feel that I might be biased, I'll probably decline reviewing such a grant.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would like other people that are reviewing my grants to behave the same way. So I haven't, you know, I've seen people being mean, but I think they were trying to be fair. But of course this happens, mm-hmm. particularly when you're reviewing papers that are all by yourself in your office, mm-hmm. and if it's a competition thing. Again, I can only say from personal experience, I try to be fair. If it's a paper that's going to scoop me, but it's well done, I really find that, you know, wouldn't be fair to turn it down. I might be a little bit more critical just because I know more about it, and maybe unconsciously I'm not happy about that. But, you know, if they have all the answers, I'll just have to swallow it, I think. So that's my experience with that. Now, in terms of falsifying data, that, you know, of course, it's a problem in science. And as the pressure mounts, it happens more and more. It's hard to tell how frequent that will happen. And in the lab, also with students and fellows, I never had such an experience, at least that I could detect. Mm-hmm. Now, you're the responsible for the lab, but in many instances, you have to trust, you know, the results that are being presented to you. And you know, there might be some fellows or students that, I don't know, let's say they have a series of 10 values, and you know, they might discard some values that are off. But if they discard the lowest and the highest for every measurement or for every group, mm-hmm. that's a fair thing, because that's a technical variation mm-hmm. problem. So I try to guide them on, you know, so that they don't try to manipulate the data too much. Mm-hmm. Try to be fair. You know, you can maybe adjust or modify your data according to the variability of the technique you're using, but you have to be fair. You cannot, you know, eliminate the high points for one group and the low points for the other group. I have been lucky, I think, with people in the lab that I never felt that someone was actually pushing the limits of honesty. Mm-hmm. But that's probably part of because of the low-pressure environment we have. Mm-hmm. I can understand if it's a very high-pressure environment, someone might, you know, just come up with lots of good data out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. Particularly if someone with, you know, weak personality, or someone that definitely has to publish something or they will die. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, happens much more in universities that are, you know, more high power, quote unquote, mm-hmm. where the pressure is much higher than here at the University of Miami. I think.
But you know, when, as you said, you, because of the mounting administrative responsibilities and things, you have less time to
supervise.
So how do you maintain quality control in your own lab?
Trust. No, besides, you know, all the mm-hmm. distractions, mm-hmm. I still am very controlling in a way. So if I have the perception that some data is not really right, I'll go back to the raw data and I'll see the curves and all mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is important to me. That's why the administrative burden bothers me, because I will still be doing it. I'll have to make my days longer, I'll have to cut on something else, but I'm still quite controlling. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I have to be careful to have enough time to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you have lab meetings, because you had one yesterday.
Yes. We have lab meetings once a week, mm-hmm. where everyone has 10 minutes to give an update on their project. As the lab grows, we might have to change that, because it becomes quite long, the lab meeting. But that's the way we have, so at least people train on how to be concise and be clear in 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And also everybody knows what everybody's doing mm-hmm. all the time. And I think also it motivates them to not come up to the meeting. Actually, it's every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And just say, you know, I've done just this one thing in 2 weeks. Doesn't look very good. No, I'm wrong. We used to have every 2 weeks. Now we have every week.
Yeah.
Just because I was having less and less time, and the lab meeting was becoming more important to me. Also because some people come to me a lot, and I like that. Others don't. Mm-hmm. And then the live meeting is helpful so that at least I know where they are. If I detect that they're going the wrong track, I can go to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we also have a journal club for the lab every 2 weeks, mm-hmm. a different day. So then we just alternate, everyone will present a paper
mm-hmm.
in the field, in our field.
Mm-hmm.
So with the lab is that, and we have the mitochondrial club, that's once a month. Mm-hmm. I also participate in another club with biochemistry, that's an RNA club.
Mm-hmm.
People in the lab are not too crazy about that, so usually go alone with one more person.
Okay.
But, you know, it's a very different area, but it's
mm-hmm.
good, I think, to be exposed to these
mm-hmm.
different things.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you get new ideas.
Yeah.
You know, if you always go to meetings in your field, you're always reading the papers related to what you do, you're going to have the same ideas that the other bright people that run labs will have.
Yeah.
If you want to have new ideas, you have to explore some other areas, either the technical level or the concept level.
Okay. Well, another ethical issue is, you know, we can do all kinds of things now that we didn't used to be able to do, like cloning animals and people, I'm sure, very soon. In Europe, there's a big hullabaloo about genetically modified food. I guess my question is, should we do everything just because we can?
Good question. that's something that I see as inevitable, really.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's in the history of the human race that if we can, we'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of genetically modified food, one can argue that we don't really need it. But someone can also argue that we need it badly because in 20, 50 years we won't have enough food to feed everybody. And, I mean, that's another ethical issue that we can discuss, that is population control. and how medicine is kind of creating a problem. In terms of, so shall we do genetically modified food? I don't know. I just think we will do it because we can.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know of any example of something that we could do that we didn't.
Well, I heard just on the news a couple of weeks ago that there are people actively pursuing cloning humans now.
Yes, they are. And they will.
And they will.
And they will. And, you know, what's wrong with that? We're playing gods. How different is that from making, you know, an in vitro fertilization? As someone commented on TV, I saw that, you know, when that started, people thought it was crazy and
mm-hmm.
anti-ethical. And nowadays, it's seen as a common form of infertility treatment.
Mm-hmm.
People, I think, have a wrong idea of cloning, that you're going to create the same person. I don't think it's true at all.
Yeah.
You are not going to be able to reproduce the environment
mm-hmm.
that a certain person grew in. So I don't really have a problem with cloning a person. It might have some tremendous benefits in terms of organ transplantations or things like this. You know, you create a sibling that can save your life. I don't know. There are a number of ethical issues, of course, involved.
Yeah.
But some families might choose to do it. Is that wrong? I don't know. Maybe if the technology is there and that's their choice, maybe it's a valid thing. So what are my views on this? I like basic life. I like quote-unquote primitive life. I don't like what the human race is doing to Earth in general. You know, we are way too many. We are displacing other species. we are changing the environment because we have to produce food for so many people. And really, nobody's doing anything about this. All we do is to try to make people live longer so that, and less people that will die, even if they are in very poor conditions. And that's just compounding the problem. So, I see those things as much bigger problems than cloning a human or creating genetically modified food. I think those things are changing our environment much more and making a world that I don't particularly like. So my main ethical problems really are with population control. Mm-hmm. And all the effort we do to, keep everybody alive. Now, this is a huge ethical problem also. And I can, as an example, is the AIDS epidemics in Africa. You probably were not there, or maybe you were. It was during the reunion meeting. I don't remember. But one of the Pew meetings, they described some shocking things about what's going on in Africa, how, so many people are dying. But, you can take an alternative view and think that these things develop when population is very high, when viruses usually propagate when those conditions are created. And it's a way to control population. Now, we're definitely, you cannot see a child suffering and not do anything about it. That's our nature. So I'm pretty sure that we're going to ultimately control that, and this disaster is going to stop and the population start to grow again, not only in Africa but everywhere else in the world. And I'm really concerned to where we're going to, and how the world is going to look like when we are 12 billion. And I'm also amazed that the governments are not really being more active with this. China has been extremely criticized for doing something related to birth control. Of course, they're maybe already too late because they have billions and billions of people. But at least they start trying to do something. Of course, religion has a major stake at that. They're completely against it, and they think we should procreate until the earth explodes. But that's really my main ethical problem that I have is, how we're not controlling the population.
Mm-hmm. But actually, in a way, biomedical science is contributing to that problem because we're trying to find cures and ways to keep people alive longer.
Of course it is. Mm-hmm. So what I do is against, what I think... I don't know. It's compounding what I see as a major problem.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There is a duality there. Human beings are extremely curious.
Let's pause for a second. Okay, we're back on tape.
Yeah, I think I was talking about the duality of... for human beings that, like in my case, for example, I'm very curious about the natural forces, and I want to understand them better. Mm-hmm. And, there's a lot of satisfaction in finding something that can help cure a disease.
Mm-hmm.
But as I just mentioned, as a species, I think we're going... through a very dangerous phase of not paying attention to overpopulation and mm-hmm. just trying to cure things.
Yeah.
And forgetting that there's a limit to how many people can live.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, there's one other ethical issue that I want to talk about, because you and I talked about it just a bit off tape, and that is the issue of animal use in research, because I know you have some mixed feelings about it, so maybe you could elaborate a little on that.
Yes. Yes, I have very mixed feelings about it. Well, the one that who gave us the right to use animals for research, we did, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you can always wonder, you know, if some big giant from another planet comes here and thinks that they can use us for research.
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with that, right? There's nothing wrong with that for them. For us, it's a big problem. You know, we can argue for a long time about the difference between human beings and animals, how we have a conscience and a memory.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, we use those things as excuses to justify what we're doing as something that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Is it right? Well, we're saying that it's right. Doesn't mean it's right.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm not happy about using animals for research,
mm-hmm.
but I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as we discussed with you, I do with the full knowledge that I'm the one that's giving me the right to do so. And that's
mm-hmm.
not a fair way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
The argument for, you know, biomedical research and using of animals is that, you know, we can save lives of children, we can save lives of many different people, you can owe your own life to animal research, and all this is true. But still, we just go back to the same point I made before, you know, who gave us the right? To me, that's the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're pretentious enough to think that our decisions are final and fair, because we say so. And that's the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do use it, but, you know, I feel just like the way I described. I feel that I'm doing something that's not fair, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let me change the tape, and then we're going to go into the final few minutes of the interview.